Praise the Lord. I am excited to be here, even though it is freezing cold outside. On days like this, I wonder why we moved back to South Carolina, or from South Carolina. And then I remember all of you lovely people, and that's why. So, and God, of course. You can be seated. I love that song, "You Are an Awesome God." As I was preparing for this lesson, I just sat there like I was reading Daniel and studying Daniel for the first time. And I just, as I was going through it, I was just amazed. And wow is all I could say every time. I would get further and further into this Bible or this book. And I, you know, we all have heard the stories. We all know about Daniel in the lion's den. We all know about the fiery furnace. But what led to those, and what is the in-between stuff that God puts in there? It's just amazing to me. And so as I was preparing, I typically, when I'm going to teach at least the first 2 weeks or the 2 weeks leading up to, my lesson becomes my study, my devotion for the day, for those few weeks. So I really, really start digging in, and God, show me there's a reason and there's a purpose you've aligned me to teach this lesson. And so what is it that I need to learn from this? And then what can I share with those that are listening to apply to their lives? And as I was scrolling through Waste Book one day, something came up from a friend that I wanted to share. The post is from Rich Bitterman, and I want to remind us, our God is not a God of politics. He is a God, the God of God, and he's a God for his kingdom. And so as I was reading this, and I was just like, oh my, this is exactly what I was thinking. And then he goes into the story of Daniel. So Rich Bitterman posts, "Thank you for the disruption of the church service in Minnesota. The doors were already open when the voices came. A pastor paused mid-sentence. It happened on a Sunday morning in Minnesota during a service that looked ordinary until it wasn't. Shoes scuffed, a few people stood, others stayed seated, hands still folded, unsure whether to look down or look up. The sanctuary designed for praise became contested ground. Arguments will swirl around that moment. They already have, as motives are weighted and causes defended, lines drawn and redrawn. Yet beneath the debate lies a simpler truth that should somber the church more than any headline. A boundary was tested, and it held only because people inside the room chose how to respond. That is why this moment matters. History teaches that pressure on the church rarely arrives dressed as persecution. It arrives first as intrusion, a disruption here, a rule there, an insistence that worship yield to urgency. In the last century, movements shaped by rigid ideology often treated the church as rival authority. Not because hymns threaten tanks, but because prayer forms allegiances that does not bend easily. The earliest signals were seldom dramatic. They were interruptions tolerated, boundaries blurred, and sanctuaries repurposed for political theater. We've seen this through the Bible and through history. Only later did pressure harden into policy. The disruption does not prove a grand scheme. One event cannot bear that weight, yet it serves as a warning flare. It shows how easily a worship service can be seized and turned into a tool for pressure. Warnings like this are gifts if they are received while there is still time to prepare. Daniel knew the value of early preparation." His post continues about Daniel's story and what we can learn. I will stop reading his words and pick up where our lesson begins. "The book of Daniel starts right after the children of Israel were taken into captivity because of a natural consequences for breaking their covenant with God. They engaged in idolatry and ignored God's commandments. They essentially were committing spiritual infidelity. The kings of Judah eventually rebelled against the kings of Babylon, leading to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Israel was given warnings that if they continued in sin, they would be exiled. The prophet Jeremiah was one of them. Judah was in captivity for 70 years, and during this time, God used it to refine them and bring them back to him. This was one of the many times that God would use captivity to bring the Israelites back to him. We often referred to it in Sunday school as recycled sin. We'd see Israel go into sin, they would repent. After being in captivity, then God would release them, then they would do it again, and it just kind of this cycle over and over and over again for them. Daniel's story, believe it or not, begins when he's 16 to 18 years old. He's not an old man. He's not a middle-aged man. He's a young man. Daniel 1, 3 through 4 says, "And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding, science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans." King Nebuchadnezzar, he was a man of war, and he had established a great empire in the world. He knew how to conquer what he wanted, and he knew how to get it. He intended to change these men's names. He intended to feed them his food, and he intended to make sure they looked like a Babylonian in the clothes that they wore. He wanted them to be Babylonian. How hard could it be to change teenagers' minds? How hard could it be to convert teenagers? I wonder that sometimes about my own children. Did my teaching stick? To their relationship with God, is it bigger than the what they might face? One of the first things the king did was change their names. When we study the Bible, we can see that names are chosen because of what they mean. People were not named carelessly. There was a reason. Daniel, meaning God is my judge, was changed to Belteshazzar, meaning Bel protects his life, referencing a Babylonian deity. Hananiah meant God's gift was changed to Shadrach, meaning Aku's command, another Babylonian deity. Mishael, meaning who is like God, was changed to Meshach, meaning who is like Aku, another deity. Azira, meaning whom the Lord helps, was changed to Abednego, meaning servant of Nego, another Babylonian deity. It's amazing how their names pointed to the one true God. And the king changed them to point to their gods. Prior to being taken into captivity, I doubt these young men really knew what a hard life was like. They probably didn't have to face a lot of ups and downs, and they were able to stand in a protected space. What we see in this story is that David knew without a doubt who God was. He knew without a doubt who he served, which tells me that his parents, or those that were involved in his life, stuck despite the nation of Israel's choices to serve other gods. His family chose to teach him what was right and what was wrong. Daniel knew who he served. How many of us can say that without a doubt? I know the God that I serve. I don't just read his word. I don't just sit in a sanctuary and listen to somebody else tell me what they know about God. Do I truly know who God is? Do you truly know who God is? The next thing the king did was made sure they ate of his food. I'm sure Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azaria never thought that their choice in a meal would mean so much. Daniel 1:8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Daniel had found favor with the head of the palace, so he asked to be exempt. Daniel must have made an impression on this man because he honored it. He knew that if he did this, that there was the potential that he could have taken, that there would be a consequence for choosing to disobey the king's ruling. But Daniel goes to him and he says, you know what? Try us for 10 days. Let us eat the fruit. Let us eat or drink water. Vegetables and water. And come to us in 10 days and see how we look. Do we look better than the ones who ate of the king's food? Or do we look worse? And so as we all know, he comes back and they look better. He had stood for God's law and God who had come through. Daniel's preparation for what his life would hold for the next 70 years had begun at home. Daniel did not rationalize picking through the different dishes, avoiding the forbidden foods that were in them, and picking out what he could or could not eat. Instead, he said, forget it. I'm not even going to deal with that. I'm not even going to touch it. I'm going to stand out, and I'm going to only follow what God has asked me to do. He would not defile himself publicly or privately. There were probably other Israelites that were there, but Daniel's stand to follow God's expectations affected not just him, but we know three other men. The choices of these four men would change their lives forever. They drew the line in the sand, and they weren't willing to compromise even when uncertainty of their lives and the lives of the king's staff were at risk. They drew their line ready to face the consequences if they didn't conform. Daniel would not allow his circumstances to define who he was, because he knew who he was in God's kingdom. His identity was a child of God, and that he would stand in that. He understood the covenant between him and God. Daniel 9:4, and I prayed unto the Lord my God and made my confession and said, O Lord, the great and dreadful God, keeping the covenant and mercy to them that love him and to them that keep his commandments. So he knew if I keep my commandments, or if I keep God's commandments, he's going to keep me. He's going to take care of me. Where are you in understanding the covenant that we have with God? Where are you in the preparation to be ready to face what's thrown at us? We live in a blessed nation, and up until recently, in the last several years, it's hard to imagine that a Christian would be persecuted in the United States of America. We've lived in freedom. I was in Belarus for almost 9 months on an AIM trip. It was so volatile. There were moments we couldn't have church in public, and then there were moments that we could. We never knew day to day what the ruler or the president would say we could or could not do. So sometimes we met in a church building, sometimes we met in our apartment crowded in, but we were desperate. They were desperate to hear God's word, and they didn't care. We weren't quiet when we worshiped. We were in an apartment. There were a chance that we could be found out, but we did it. Daniel 1:7, as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So God had blessed them. God had shown them and given them wisdom, and Daniel was given a little bit more. He was able to interpret dreams and see visions. Daniel and the other Hebrew men were not your average teenagers. There was wisdom beyond their years, what we would call probably an old soul. And God had gifted Daniel with the ability to interpret visions and dreams. At the end of their 3 years of training, the king could find no one that was like Daniel, Hananiah, Messiah, and Azariah. These young men had wisdom and understanding that was 10 times better than the men that the king had surrounded himself with. These were the king's words, not God's. What a gift, and Daniel did not squander that gift. He didn't squander what he was given. He realized what he had. He also didn't take credit for what he had. Whenever he walked in his gift, the first thing that he did was give God the glory. He pointed them to God, not himself. King Nebuchadnezzar goes on to have a dream. He calls on his magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to not just interpret the dream, but also to tell him what the dream was. He wasn't playing around. He wanted to make sure that when they came to him, that they knew what the dream was and that what they had to say was really, really the interpretation. He didn't play games. In this moment, he threatened that if you do not tell me it correctly, I will tear you and your family from limb to limb. That's pretty high stakes there. I think I'd shut my mouth and walk away and hide, keep my head down. I don't want anybody to know. Just let me keep going my way. None of them could interpret the king's dream, and none of them knew what the dream was. The king became angry. And just like they would lose their head if they interpret wrong, they were going to die because they didn't interpret or even attempt to. The decree had gone out. He was going to have the wise men killed to include Daniel and the other three men. But Daniel said, wait a minute, hold up a second. In his boldness, he doesn't go just straight to the king. He goes to the guard, the king's guard, the captain, and says, wait a minute, what's going on? What's happening? And he says, wait, can I interpret the dream before we kill anybody? That's boldness, to walk to the man that's going to probably take your life and ask him to hold on a second, because maybe he can interpret it. He stood with God. He knew where he stood. He doesn't just run to the king. He takes the night to think about it. He doesn't just sit alone either or meander over it alone. And yes, there will be times that that was probably appropriate, but this time he went to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he said, look, this is where we're at. This is what's going on. I need you to pray with me that God would interpret this for me and I can bring it forward to save our lives and many more. Daniel woke. I don't know how he slept. I have a hard time sleeping over the littlest things sometimes. But Daniel slept and he awoke, and the first thing out of his mouth was to give God the glory. He knew God had revealed to him during the night in a vision what the dream was and what the interpretation was. He had the confidence that the God that he stood for would stand with him when he went before the king, where he could potentially lose his life. He made sure the king understood that Daniel's interpretation and the telling of the dream wasn't about Daniel, but it was about what God wanted to reveal to the king and what his heart looked like. In the dream, a stone came out of nowhere, hitting a statue that was made of different things. It hit the feet of the statue, and the whole statue broke into pieces. What does that mean? Daniel tells the king the statue represents earthly kingdoms that were established from Babylon, and these kingdoms would fill the earth with violence. The stone represents God's kingdom. It will come and confront and humble the arrogant kingdoms, and his justice would fill the earth as he reigned. Daniel 3:45, the latter part of the scripture says, the great God hath made known to the king that shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. It was sure. It was right. It was correct. The king knew. The king knew that it was right. King Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges God as the God of all gods. He gives God glory. Daniel went in standing with God, and he left with God standing with him. He went in glorifying God and left with the king glorifying God. And I thought it was so cool after Pastor Peter preached on glorifying God, and then this lesson comes in today. The king attempts to elevate Daniel, but Daniel passes the promotion on to three other Hebrew men. He doesn't take the reward. His reward was knowing that God had stood with him his life. Let this sink in for just one second. Like I said earlier, Daniel was not old. When this occurred, he was probably about 20 years old. 20, that's young. How many 20-year-olds in here are still figuring out their life? How many 35-year-olds are in here still figuring out their lives? I mean, when I was 40, I was still figuring things out. And even at almost 50, I'm still figuring things out. But to be 20 and to know where you are and to know who your God was, to know that this young 20-year-old had a sensitivity to God that I only hope and wish and strive for in my walk with him. When there is a consecration to God and they are standing in covenant with God, watch out what our young people and people can do. And when they are surrounded with friends that are also standing with God, there is a force that will be reckoned with. Daniel's story is not accidental in the Bible, and there is a purpose for every event that is in the book. None of the other Hebrew captains are mentioned, only these four, an entire book devoted to four. The book of Daniel is told, and it's used to encourage you and I to stand for what we believe in, even when it's not easy. He lives out his faith in God, and in the face of adversity, he's able to stand. He wasn't content with becoming a chameleon and blending in with Babylon. When we choose to blend in, we cannot fulfill our God-given kingdom purpose. You cannot do a purpose if you look and act and are somebody else. You have to be yourself. You have to walk in who God created you to be. When our life decisions are based on the will of God and what his word says, we will find that God will stand with us and for us. As you can hear, there is a theme here. That does not mean we will not face adversity. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. But it means that when we prepare and we have him at our side, when we go through adversity, we have a peace that passes all understanding, that he is standing next to me, he's standing with me, and if I need him to, he's going to carry me where I need to go. And he's going to be my God. Despite Nebuchadnezzar's praise of God, he did not set aside false gods. He didn't set aside his false religion. We see in chapter 3 that he proceeds to build a gold statue, and he gathers all of his leaders to bow down to this golden statue. But those Hebrew men that came with those leaders had already took a stand. They knew who they were. And when the king requested that they bow when that music played, they didn't. They didn't bow down. They knew the consequence was death. They didn't know what the consequence was going to be if they refused to follow the king's ways, but they knew without a doubt that if they didn't bow to that statue, there would be death. It was clear. The king made it very clear. They first reminded him of what he said when the enemy went to the king and he said, "Hey, just so you know, I want to remind you of your decree that if they don't bow down, they're going to go into the fiery furnace." So they didn't first tell him who. They made sure he knew what his decree was. Then he said, "Just so you know, it's these three boys, these three men refused to bow down." I'm sure the king was sad because he knew. He didn't elevate them for nothing. He knew Daniel. Daniel 3, 16 through 18, it says, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up.'" This is what they said to him when he gave them a second chance. It didn't matter. They said, he might save us, he might not, and that's okay, because he's still God no matter what happens in this situation. The king, I'm sure, was angered. He was embarrassed. They had, in front of his leaders, denied a second chance to bow down and escape death. We can see the Bible tells us that his expression changed towards them when they chose not to bow down. And the king asked that the fire be increased seven times. Seven times hotter. The fire was so hot that the soldiers, the guards who threw them in, died just from being next to it. He asked the question, "Hey, wait, hold on a second." When he looks in there and the three men are in there and he says, "Wait a minute, weren't there only three? How do we have four in there?" Not only that, how are four people walking around in a fire that the men who were standing on the outside died? That's God. It didn't take long for God to show up. He was right there. His question is confirmed, and he responds with Daniel 3:25. And he answered and said, "Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." The covenant-keeping God didn't just show up. He walked right into the fire with his children and made sure that they didn't just know he was there, but the king knew. The king knew that God was there. So you can be sure the three men saw their God standing. The covenant God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was also the covenant God of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He's our covenant God. He stands with us. For these three, their faith in God was all-encompassing. Their lives stood out against the crowd. Their character and integrity are known. Shouldn't it be the same for you and I? What is your reputation? Does your reputation mirror your character and your integrity? Should we not throw our whole hearts into living for our God? What is our life on this earth after all? It is but a vapor. In a minute, it's gone. Compared to eternity, it's so small. They give an example of somebody who writes two circles, trying to understand the differences between Christians, especially in the Western world, and other faiths. And there's two circles with a dot right in the middle of it. And this man says, this circle here is the Muslims. The dot in them, in the center, is themselves. And everything around that dot is Islam, is the God they serve. The other circle is the Christians. The Christians are not at the center. That dot is not the Christian. It's God. And everything else that they do revolves. God revolves around the things that they do. They fill that empty void. They fill it with the things of the world. It's hard to reach us because everything we do, our life is not filled with God. It's not centered on God. So we become just this small dot in the middle, or he becomes a small dot in the middle, unlike the other religions. We see that he gave God glory, but no changes again in what he worshiped. He continues to keep them at his side just like he did earlier. He has another dream, and he follows the order of the same thing with this dream. It's funny because we always say if you do the same action and get the same results, probably don't do it again at some point. But he does it, and he calls all his wise men, and none of them can interpret his dream. But then he remembers Daniel, and Daniel comes in and he interprets this dream. And he tells him, with a warning, the years of prosperity in this dream, or in his dream, could be longer if he practices righteousness. He was warned, if you continue in righteousness, basically your success and who you are will be longer. 12 months later, he forgets that warning. He turns it back on himself because he didn't change his surroundings. He didn't stand with God. Immediately, his kingdom was taken away as he elevated himself. He lost everything. He was driven out from men. He wasn't even allowed to stay amongst the men. He went into a field. He became an animal. He lost his family, his kingdom, his riches, his pride, who he was as a man. The problem was he acknowledged God, but he didn't get rid of the things that were not of God around him. He surrounded himself with the same people. It took changing and removing Nebuchadnezzar from his surroundings and putting him somewhere alone to get him to see, understand who the one true God was. Let's not wait until it's too late. Who and what are you surrounding yourself with? This was the end of the first reign that Daniel sat under. A new king entered the scene, Belshazzar. He had no respect for the things of God. He was having a party when we first meet him. And he asked his men to go to the temple and to get the gold vessels that were meant for God. And what does he do? He pours into them and they drink from them during the party. God doesn't wait. When you mess with the things of God, he doesn't wait. His heart, he was angered. God was angered and he was upset by what was happening. He began to write on the wall in the party. He shook things up. I'm sure, I can't imagine just this random hand like writing on the wall. That would be so creepy. I think all of us would probably pass out, faint, lose ourselves, I don't know, run out screaming something. But the king could not move. His legs were weak. He could not stand. He was watching as this was happening. Daniel was called. They were not able to interpret. The enemy wasn't able to interpret again, so Daniel was called. The king made a statement that he knew something was different with Daniel and that the Spirit of God had lived in him. And he knew that what you have to say would dissolve my doubts and that the interpretation would be from God. Daniel begins to tell the king that the Most High God had given success to his father, but that he allowed his heart to become hard, and because of his pride and self-elevation, he lost everything. The writing on the wall became a warning. It was revealed Belshazzar was not humble, and he saw himself as equal to God. He with his people worshiped things and used things from the one true God's temple to bring glory to themselves. They dishonored the God who had held the breath in their hands. In his hands. Belshazzar was put on notice. His kingdom was coming to an end. God had had enough. How bold of Daniel to stand before the king to tell him, hey, by the way, you're ending. I think I'd be afraid to tell him that because he has the power to kill me. But he didn't. Again, he stood with God. He knew that God would stand with him. Little did he know that what he had just said would happen that night. The king was killed in his sleep, and another king took Babylon. King Darius the Mede received the kingdom. This was the end of the second reign that Daniel was under, and it began the third. Daniel continued to find favor. We can see God continues to stand with Daniel as he stood with God. Daniel's role in leadership continues under the third reign. Daniel's reputation follows him. And the men around him are angry. They're jealous. They're upset. So they devise a way. We're going to find out what this man does. We're going to understand who he is. We're going to find something wrong with him. And we're going to bring it to the king. So they watched him. Daniel was found blameless and full of integrity, so they attacked his devotion to God, and the only way his enemies saw as a way to attack him and possibly get rid of him. Wouldn't that be awesome if the only fault somebody could find in us was the way that we worshiped in our God, that we followed his word? They devised a plan and went before the king. They tricked King Darius into decreeing that anybody who made a petition to anybody but the king would go into the lion's den. But that didn't stop Daniel. He went to his window and he openly prayed to his God three times daily. It didn't take long for Daniel to be caught praying. He didn't hide. Let me remind you, the enemy is watching you from a distance. He is watching your patterns of living. He is looking for a weak link to cut. He is studying your weaknesses and the things that you value over God. He's looking for the church that is caught up in looking the part but not living the part. He's looking for a group of people that can't stand together and how he can best use the disunity to bring down the church. Are we prepared to stand in unity for God and face what could come? Where do you stand with God? The enemy went before the king using the same tactics that had been used before. They reminded the king of what he had said before telling the king who had disobeyed. He then told him who had disobeyed. The king was distraught. He was sad. This was his friend. He had found, loved him. Daniel had found favor with this king. But he knew he had to do it. He knew he had to throw him into the fiery furnace. But he decreed, and he knew, and he said to Daniel, but your God is the God of gods. And he knew, he said it, that he's going to save him. He was thrown in, Daniel 6:20 through 21. We see that the king did not sleep, and he runs to the door of the den. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, who thou servest, continually able to deliver thee from the lions? Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. In other words, I'm alive. He had shut the mouths of the lions. The king knew that the men had set up Daniel, and the very consequence that they had come up with, they themselves received in their households. Don't mess with God's people. We are to glorify God, and King Darius glorified God. He made a decree that all were to worship and reverence God. The ship was turning towards God. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah surrounded themselves with each other. Their actions and daily life influenced each other. We can see how the three kings' choices and who they surrounded themselves with changed the outcome of their lives. Darius was the king, the third king that Daniel was under. and he continued to hold a place of leadership. We may never know how much our decisions impact the lives around us, and it's not just one directional. A leader may influence those he or she serves while present, and those people around him can continue or her to show and follow that pattern when the leader is no longer around. But in the end, the leader too may be encouraged, strengthened, and emboldened by the actions of others. No man is an island. No man is always strong, and we need each other, and we need God. We need to stay in covenant with God. Stand for God, and he will stand with us. Bishop used to say, "Show me your friends, and I'll show you your future." Know that what you put into your mind and your heart and who you allow to speak into your life will affect you. Be purposeful with who you allow into your life. Be purposeful with where you seek advice. Be purposeful who you allow to speak into your mind. We need each other, but be careful. Let's stand. I'm going to read the rest of this post as we wrap up. Fresh laws carry fresh shields, yet Daniel remains. He remains because his life has been shaped by habit. The new king needs order, so 120 officials are appointed. 3 presidents oversee them. Daniel rises above the rest, not through ambition, but through trust earned the slow way. His accounts balance, his word carries weight as his hands stay clean. Corruption finds no foothold in him, and that becomes the problem. Integrity obstructs those who want easy gain. Daniel's presence blocks the channel where stolen wealth should flow. His enemies study him and find no weakness in his work, so they look elsewhere. They notice his prayers. They understand something crucial. Daniel's faithfulness to the king grows out of his faithfulness to God. His kneeling shaped his standing. Remove the kneeling, and the standing collapses. The plan takes form with words, smooth words, a decree that lasts 30 days, a small window, request directed through royal authority. Worship is allowed, provided it bends. The law settles into place, unchangeable by customs. Daniel hears the decree. He walks home and he climbs the stairs. The windows remain open towards Jerusalem. Light spills across the floor. Dust hangs in the air. Knees meet wood. Words rise. His prayer, as he did before. Morning prayer passes, midday prayer follows, evening prayer returns, each time the same temptation whispers. Adjust, delay, close the window. Preserve the position, extend the influence. Daniel answers with silence and obedience. The courage seen in the lion's den grows from these ordinary refusals. The danger in Minnesota was not lions, it was interruption. A demand that worship yields its moment. The test was quieter than Daniel's, yet it asked a similar question. Would the gathered people allow prayer to be reshaped by pressure, or would they remain steady? History shows how much hinges on moments like that. When churches learn to brace for intrusion, they often learn to edit themselves. Hymns shorten and sermons soften. Prayers become cautious. The change happens gradually, justifying each step of the way. That pattern has appeared before in places where ideology sought to reorder allegiance. Daniel refused to edit his ways or his prayers. Guards escorted him away as officials watched with satisfaction. The king winced and trapped by his own signature. Daniel descended into darkness. Straw rustled, breath steamed, muscles shifted. An angel arrived with authority and the night passed. At dawn, Daniel rose unmarked. His deliverance was real, yet it was not the point. The miracle grew from the ordinary. Prayers spoke when prayers became constant and when they became costly. This is where the St. Paul moment presses the church toward clarity. The positive hidden inside disruption is alertness. It wakes us while there is still room to choose our habits deliberately. The call is not outrage. Outrage burns energy without building endurance. The call is not to retreat. Retreat shrinks worship into something private and fragile. The call is preparation shaped by faithfulness. Preparation often looks unremarkable. It's scripture spoken aloud at a service, its knees meeting the floor when no one is watching. These practices train believers to stand when standing costs something. Daniel did not discover courage under pressure. Courage found him ready because he had practiced obedience when the cost felt small. The habit formed at 18, 14, 6. The habit formed and held until 80. The church today stands at a similar threshold. The warning has sounded softly as sanctuary was interrupted and service was paused. The question is, what will we do? The course of action emerges from Daniel's example in the moment we inhabit. Prayer at set times, not only when emotion swells, habit steadies the heart. Teach children obedience in small things, because large trials grow from small refusals practiced over time. Keep worship central and visible, even when visibility invites scrutiny. Prepare calmly for disruption by agreeing in advance that prayer will continue. Voices will lower rather than rise, and worship will not surrender its purpose. These actions do not shout, they endure. The protesters' interruptions remind us that the church does not control the world's response. It controls its own faithfulness. That faithfulness carries weight precisely because it refuses to perform. Daniel's story ends with the king's passing from the stage and empire shifting like sand. Daniel continues, the remnants remain, that remains true today. Pressure will come in many forms. Some will roar, some will whisper. The response must be the same. Knees on wood, windows open, prayer steady, courage quiet. A warning received early because of mercy. It sharpens vision, it strips illusion, it invites the church. To remember who it is before the test grows heavier. The doors opened that Sunday morning as they always had. Hinges groaned, sunlight fell across the familiar faces. The interruption revealed something that had been there all along. Worship still matters to be contested. That knowledge carries responsibility, and the time to pray and the time to stand with God has arrived. What will we choose to do? I'm going to have us bow our heads in prayer to think about what we can learn from Daniel. And I would encourage you to go back to the book of Daniel when you have time and just really dig into the word of God for yourself. Don't just take my words and what I feel God has revealed or what this lesson has said. God, I pray right now that you would help us to stand for you. God, I pray that you would guide us and you would direct us, and that every day that our lives, that our habits, that the things that we do, the things that we say, the moments in our lives, that they would be surrounded with you, that they would speak of you, that our prayer would be what goes up every day to prepare us for the things that matter. God, that we, as we stand for you, no matter the pressure that we might face, no matter what comes down, that God, we're able to stand steadfast in your word, and then the things that we have learned and the things that we study. And God, I pray that you would help us to stand in unity with each other, that we would inspire and strengthen each other, God, that we would sharpen our iron with each other, and God, that we could walk forward in your kingdom. And I pray, Lord, that as we walk out of here, that we would apply, oh God, the lessons from Daniel and the three Hebrew men, God, that we would apply them to our lives to stand for you in the end days. In Jesus' name.